Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to talk to 92-year-old Jimmy Weldon. If you grew up in Dallas, Texas, or in one of a few different places in California, maybe you remember him on television as Uncle Jimmy Weldon and his friend Webster Webfoot. Maybe you're more of a Yaki Doodle fan from the Yogi Bear cartoon. That was Jimmy, too. But during World War II, he was sent overseas with the 1270th Combat Engineer Battalion. And in so many ways, it changed his life, as we're going to hear.
Everybody seems to have a welcome to the war moment, if you will. A spot where you saw, oh, this is what it's really like. Was there a moment like that for you where you realized that what you were doing was potentially dangerous and hazardous to your health?
I think we were too young. We were just going, whatever they said. Let's go. Come on, guys.
But I mean, when I hear clearing minefield, I mean, that doesn't sound like an adventure to me. That sounds like, uh-oh, if I make a wrong step or poke the wrong spot, I might die.
Well, right, but at that point, we were so carefully taught things to do that we didn't think about that.
What was that process like? What would you guys do if you had an area of land that they say there may still be mines in here and you have to remove them or disable them? How would that work?
I had all kinds of ways of going through it. But mainly our stuff was still building the pontoon bridges and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget when we went through Buchenwald concentration camp and we saw these people laying on these wooden slabs, reaching out under there trying to say thank you. Thank you for helping us. We thought, I can't believe this. It's not possible. We walk on through the barracks and we go out in the back and there are cubicles back there in the back. Hundreds of bodies nude laying in these cubicles just like they've been thrown out like you would with cattle or something waiting to be cremated. We thought, this is not possible. That will I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
But
had you ever, before you got there to Buchenwald, had you ever heard of this idea of a concentration camp? Did you know that the Jews were being exterminated and tortured and treated the way they were?
Well, we heard it, but it didn't register because it's like a lot of people didn't even know this when they lived very close to it because they kept it away from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You're young. See, again, we're young kids, and we're in the Army. We're going. We tried to have as much fun as we could, even though it was strictly, you never know what's going to happen.
And you alluded a moment ago to that air of invincibility or that, you know, that bravado of youth that says, hey, it might happen to somebody else, but it's not going to happen to me.
Yes. Yeah.
That said, in your time overseas, did you ever have that thought, I might not make it back home to America?
No.
Not once?
No. Can't remember that.
Did you feel that you had some kind of protection that was going to bring you home?
Well, yeah, faith, you got that. That's the only thing. I had so much deep faith that I've never lost.
Mm-hmm.
That means more than it kills me when someone doesn't even have any faith of any kind. At my age, you think, oh, golly. I was married to a little English girl for 40 and a half years. Mm-hmm. After the war was over, I stayed in England, went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. Can you imagine me? How now, brown cow? You all. But I went and I met her at the Stage Door Canteen, which was like for over here, and Rainbow Corner is called. And every week I'd put on a show for the soldiers. Mm-hmm. All over where I met her, Muriel. Then we started going. I met her mother and dad, and I said, I'd like for her to come to America. And so we tried to make arrangements for me to come to America, but I didn't have a job or anything. She couldn't come. They wouldn't let her come over with me. But I came over by myself a year and a half later. Dad had to post a $500 bond to get her over here because I didn't have any money anyway. But I promised him, I said, if you let Muriel come to America and she likes my family, we'll get married. If she doesn't, I'll send her home. Nobody's hurt. But if we do get married, we're going to stay married, and I'll see she gets home. Well, they thought, that's fine. Once he leaves, she'll forget about him. But she came over a year and a half later. We were married September the 26th, 1947, she went home 39 times during the next 40 and a half years we were married. I brought her mother over here twice, her mother and dad once, and they said, you kept your promise.
I guess so. And I want to explore more of that. And I know, again, we're going in and out here, but I want to make sure I capture all of this, too. So you mentioned the concentration camp. And my grandfather was there at Buchenwald, and I heard his stories, and it haunted him for years. I mean, he had nightmares and flashbacks of some of the things he experienced there. What was the biggest impact of that experience on you, of what you saw, what you heard, what you witnessed there?
Well, the engraved in my mind as I going through the barracks, just really to see these people, to think, I can't believe here. They're just there laying on those wooden slabs, just enough room to slide in and out. And then I remember seeing one man when we went in the back in one place. He was just sitting there, the little face looking like, I don't know what's happening. He was just alone sitting there, and I thought, golly, I couldn't talk to him or anything. There's no way. But those are the things that are in my mind that I wouldn't want to forget either. But
sounds like it was appalling to you, but also just shocking to know that people could be treated that way.
That's right. That's it. I'll never forget our platoon sergeant when he stood there and started crying, and I thought, golly, Moses. Powerful guy, but it was through such, like, I can't, what's happened? What are we seeing? What are we seeing here? We're going through things, we're doing things that are not as close to this. And I think, well, that was it. We were fortunate in the sense that I missed a lot of that. When we were doing our work, we were kind of by ourselves. But when you see the things like concentration camps, at 92, I'm still thinking, it's almost a dream.
But you described for us an incident in a classroom where you're speaking and someone tells you it didn't happen, and that rose up righteous anger in you to set him straight. And you also talked about a rabbi in the back of the room who had been a child.
Yes.
At Buchenwald. I can't imagine what that felt like to meet him in that setting.
Oh, listen, it knocked me out. And later I did a program with thing called SPIRDVAC. We have over here, it says Society for Preservation of Early Radio Vaudeville. We're sitting at a table, and I was telling them about this, and the person in that group said, Jimmy, Rabbi Kane was our rabbi. I said, was? He said, yeah, he passed away 6 months ago, and it just knocked me out because I just said, oh, golly. Because we became such good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you think, there it is. Look, Nancy Reagan died. It happens.
And a lot of times history dies with people, including a lot of World War II veterans who don't talk about what they did. And I'm just thinking about your story. If you're in a minefield and something goes off, we might have you. We might not have ever had these characters you do. You wouldn't have met your wife in England and all of that.
Yeah.
But about a month after the liberation of Buchenwald, Nazi Germany surrenders, VE Day. Was that a big day for you?
Oh, yes. Yes, you talk about dancing in the streets. We couldn't even imagine such a thing. Oh, golly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other question that comes to mind, people are thinking, okay, if he has this much energy at 92, what was he like at 21 or maybe even younger than that? When you were overseas in the Army, were you entertaining? I know afterwards you told us in England, but while you're actually with this engineer outfit, were you doing some of these voices or entertaining your fellow soldiers?
Yeah, every time they had someone come over that was a celebrity, they would put a program, and I did the MC. I was MC of the program and did something. And when the war was over, Colonel Connors, who was our battalion commander, called me, and he said, I want you to go into Chafe Headquarters, General Eisenhower. He went over, and he said, this fellow should have been in the entertainment industry, entertainment department of the Army all of his career. He said, so we're going to move him into here.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into Chafe Headquarters, and that's where I spent the last few weeks in the Army before I went to the Royal Academy. We were sitting there, and one of the guys said, are you going to stay over here and go to school? I said, no, I'm not going to school. I'm an actor. I'm going to Hollywood. Said, well, why don't you stay here and go to school? I said, I don't want to go to school. And they said, well, why don't you just look at what we have? I said, give me the list. Let me have it. I saw all these great universities things. I got into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I said, that's the one I want to go to. They said, you got the only one and you couldn't get in. I said, give me a pass. I went over to London and met Sir Kenneth Barnes, who was the head of the Royal Academy. And I said, Sir Kenneth, I got to come to this school. I told him a story about when I was a little boy and about how I cried and said, Mama, he killed that guy. I said, I've got to be an actor. He said, by Jove, I'd accept you. And that's so That's why I went to Royal Academy. Can you imagine that?
Backtracking again, when you say that you emceed any time one of these USO shows and a celebrity would come by, who are some of those names?
Mickey Rooney came in, and he and I had the same birthday. He died. He was just 3 years older than I am. But I let him use my gun that Dad sent me overseas because I wanted to have a sidearm. I had a 45, and Mickey Rooney wore it in the play that he did when he came over. We talked about it later when he came out to Hollywood. I never thought I'd see him again.
Mm-hmm.
But Red Skelton, I emceed his program at Camp Swift when he did a program. He used to go around. Any of the celebrities that came out, they'd say, get Shin. That's my name. I mean, right. Jimmy Weldon's
a Hollywood name.
That's it.
But
it was because of my oldest brother. Uh-huh. And the middle one, that's how I got their name. I took their names.
So who, your oldest brother?
Yeah,
was?
I was overseas. We were in had just gone into France.
Mm-hmm.
And he got this letter from Mom and Dad, and they said, Bub and Betty had a little boy, and they wanted to name him Jimmy Weldon. And he said, Bub, my oldest brother said, no, we can't use no Fern's name. My oldest brother's name was Joe Weldon Shin, S-H-I-N-N. The middle boy, James Lemoyne Shin. Paul, you're sitting here with Ivy Laverne Shin. I got invitation to every woman's college that was in existence. How they ever did this, I don't know, but my dad's baby brother was named Ivy, and where they got Laverne, I don't know. But Moen and I went to school without the L.A. We'd call each other Moen and Vern. Everybody did that. So when I read this letter, they said, wanted to name him Jimmy Weldon. That's Bub's first name, second name and Moen's first name.
Yeah.
And I said, Jimmy Weldon, I like that name. That's what I'm going to be known as for right now. That was right in France.
You're still in the service. You're still Ivan Laverne Shin.
That's right. And then I go into Shave headquarters, I told these guys, I said, I've got a new name I want to use. And these fellas said, you're Jimmy Weldon for us. I was almost engaged to Muriel before she knew I wasn't Jimmy Weldon because they said something about she's going over to going. She's I'm going to America, and said, "What relation is she to you?" And she said, "That's my husband, gonna be, because Ivy Laverne. That's got to be women." I told Mom, "I said, where in the thunder you all got those names?" But anyway, it's amazing. Muriel was on Little House on the Prairie 8 years. Trapper John 5 years as a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Famous. I mean, great dancer.
Yeah, you were a Hollywood couple, to be sure. But how you didn't tell us the story of how you met. You told us you met her and you brought her home as a war bride, but how did you meet Muriel?
All right. I was putting on my show over there at Rainbow Corner.
Uh-huh.
And she was supplying drinks for the soldiers behind the desk. In fact, anyone that was in the entertainment industry over there, part of their work, their actual work was to entertain the soldiers or be at Rainbow Corner serving drinks and dance with them and something.
Mm-hmm.
So she was serving Cokes. She said, would you like to dance with me? And I said, I'm not a good dancer. And she said, well, I'm not either. Either like that. And so we got on the dance floor and I said, man, you can't dance very well, can you? She said, no. Later, I go down to see where she is. She said, would you see the show I'm in? She was one of the principal dancers at the Night in the Music, the longest running show in London, Vic Oliver's Night in the Music. He was married to Sarah Churchill, Vic Winston's daughter.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw her, I said, good golly, there's Muriel out on that stage. She's one of the principal dancers. And I said, she can't dance. But anyway, we had a great life. 40 and a half years, look out. I tell people now. I said, Muriel was married to her 4.5 years, little English girl, then she left me. They said, oh, that's an English girl. I said, oh, wait a minute, I don't know where she is. Oh, really? I said, yeah, now tell them the story. I was in the hospital with her at St. Joseph's Hospital, crying my heart out. And she said, oh, darling, please pray to let Jesus take me now. I said, what's going to happen to me? She said, you have such a wonderful life motivating others about their future. Don't cry. I'll just be there waiting for you. And I watched her pass away right there in front of me. I tell everybody I don't know where she is. Denver Pyle. Do you remember his name? The actor?
Mm-hmm.
I gave Muriel's memorial service. He said, you can't do this. I said, I'm the only one that can. So in our church, when he walked out, I walked over and Denver and his wife, Tippy, were sitting over to the side. And I said, hey, Denver, why are you and Tippy sitting way over here? And he said, Weldon, if the show's no good, I'm leaving. That was at Muriel's memorial service. We had a good time. But anyway, that's life goes on. You can't stop.
Nope. And Jimmy Weldon doesn't even sound like he's slowing down, does he? I had such a great time with this energetic 92-year-old that we're going to spend the next show with him, too. We'll hear how his career in entertainment progressed and talk more about his quest to help younger generations come to love America as much as he does. Again, check out the video and photos at hometownheroesradio.com as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time for more from Jimmy Weldon. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.